Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 20, delivered on November 3, 2016. The title of this lecture is Metrics of Risk.
Tonight, Metrics of Risk. Now, to some extent, you have seen this before in your class, your stats class. I know you were exposed to the mean and the standard deviation. I'm not going to beat you up with it here. Truth be told, your calculator, your basic Texas Instruments calculator, you can key in data and get the mean and the standard deviation. Excel is wonderful for this. I should probably point out that in notation, if I write the Greek symbol mu, that is generally intended to represent the mean of the population, the average population. If I wanted to know what the average weight of an ISU student was, I'd weigh all of you, everyone here who attends, and I would divide by the number of students. That would give me the average weight of the population, the mu. However, if I took a sample, I don't want to weigh everybody. That would be the sample mean. That would be a much more likely thing for a statistician to get, to calculate, especially in destructive testing. You would, if you have to destroy something in order to measure it, you're not going to use the population at all. Okay, so now the next one is the standard deviation. Now, the mean is a sum from I equals 1 to n of 1 over n times the x of I. In other words, it's a fancy way of saying add them up and divide by the number. Just add them up and divide by the number. That tells you the center, kind of like the center. The spread, the risk, the volatility, what have you, is measured by the variance and its square root, the standard deviation. The variance is going to be the sum from I equals 1 to n of each data point minus the mean squared, and then 1 over n. If it's the population, it would be 1 over n minus 1 if it is a sample. Be careful if you're using a basic calculator that can calculate standard deviations. Make sure you know whether that calculator is giving you the sample or the population standard deviation. In most of the problems you'll be doing for, in finance in your homework, it would be the n minus 1 that you would be wanting to use, not the n. And you can do this either, you know, just calculate the average and then just take each data point minus the average, square it. Now, of course, the standard deviation, which is more interesting to us, is the square root of the variance. This will be in the right units. Variance is always in the square of the units that you were initially working in. Once you take the square root, then you're working the standard deviations in your original units of measure. Okay. Now here is the upshot of this. And I do caution that you have to be careful. Supposedly, well, they teach and in undergrad and a lot of grad work, you assume that your population is distributed normally. In other words, your data is sampling from a bell curve like that. You're assuming that. That's not actually a very good assumption. In fact, it's actually a bad assumption for certain data. And they always say, well, if you get a large enough sample size, everything becomes a normal. Actually, no, it doesn't. Everything does not become a normal, especially certain types of data. But we assume that for most intents and purposes, our data will lie on a bell curve. Here's the nice thing about mean and standard deviation. In a normal distribution, the center is symmetric around the mean. That's not true with some. For example, there are distributions like the chi and the f that are skewed. They're actually much more common, especially in some kinds of fields like education data, certain expectancies of survival rates of products like light bulbs and things like that. They behave more like the skewed distribution here. The logic there being that you can't have a negative life expectancy of a light bulb. So it can't be a normal. Large sample size can't make it a normal. But we'll assume for returns on stocks, a normal wouldn't hurt to assume. Now, the spread is represented by the standard deviation. Here's the thing about that spread. About 67% of the time, your data will lie between the average and one standard deviation below to the average plus one standard deviation above. 67% of the time, your data, if you find your average, you find your standard deviation, 67% of the time about, your data will fall in that band from X bar minus sigma to X bar plus sigma. Another one that's useful to know is if it's a normal distribution. This has nothing to do with business or stocks. This is the characteristic of a normal distribution. Your data will lie within two standard deviations of the mean. This becomes practically useful. And I'll show you exactly how in my own company how I can use this information. Let's see if I remember to bring a piece of paper with me. Okay, got it. Let me show you. Over the past 5 years, and making a few adjustments for certain things, I know that my average profit, free cash flow, my average free cash flow has been this number right here. I added up the revenue for the last 5 years and divided by 5. And that's the number I got. Then what I did was I took that number. I took each year's free cash flow minus that number, squared it, divided by 5 minus 1, which is 4, because it's a sample, not the population, it's a sample. And then I took the square root of it, and I got my sigma. And that came out to be that number. Just using plain old Excel. I've added up my free cash flow for the 5 years, each of the 5 years, past 5 years, and then divided by 5. That's how I got the X bar. And then I took each year's cash flow minus that X bar, squared the result, and then I added up those 5 years and divided by 4, 5 minus 1, just like the formula over there for a sample. And that's the number I got there. I want to make sure you know where I got my numbers, and these are actually the real numbers. Okay? And like I said, there were a few adjustments and things I did with free cash flow along the way, but that's the real numbers right there. Okay, so now, the question that I would have for myself is I'd say, okay, I have to, some decisions I make based upon, okay, I have to have, in order to do, Ten shows next year. I've got to have at least $7,000 of free cash flow come out. I've got to have at least $7,000. I want to do 10 shows next year, and that would include some heavies: Jackson Hole, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York. I'm going to have that much, or I'm not. I would break myself. I would literally be financially ruined. I gotta pull $7,000, okay? Well, you can't say with certainty, but I would like to be 95% sure that that's what's going to happen, that I'm going to be able to pull $7,000 next year. If I can, I can pay for the shows. They make you pay for them, by the way, like 6 months in advance. So right now is when I have to start paying for those shows. So that's why this is actually a very timely problem for me. They're saying, all right, you've got to pay your, we've accepted you, you've got to pay your fees now to get into the shows. Okay, let's see if I can do it. With 95% certainty, I would have to be from X bar minus twice the standard deviation, somewhere in that band from X bar plus twice the standard deviation. So in other words, I am 95, based upon the last 5 years, I am 95% certain that I will have free cash flow of somewhere between $12,200 minus $2,054 up to $12,200 plus twice $2,054. Now running that in the calculator, and Lordy, tell me, if I run those numbers out, I pray to God it comes out the same as it did when I first did this, minus 2 times 2054. I'm 95% sure that my cash flow will be somewhere between $8,092 and plus 2 times
Really? Damn. 16,308.
And $16,308. So it's a go. That doesn't mean I know it's going to happen, but there's nothing in the future that's a crystal ball. But what I have found here is that if it is important, hugely important, that I achieve a free cash flow of at least $7,000, putting in the money for 10 shows, the entrance fees, the booth fees, then looks like I'm going to do it. That's my decision-making framework. It's fairly simple, and most businesses follow this kind of a decision-making framework. There is an underlying principle here that I want to bring up to you. And what worries me is that you're never going to be told this in another class. This principle is part of game theory. It's used in warfare, planning, logistics and transportation, operations management, and in finance, at the corporate finance. It's called the Minimax principle. When you are making a decision, you should make the decision that minimizes the maximum possible loss that could happen under a reasonable scenario. So 95% is reasonable certainty in my judgment. And on that basis, I'm a go for paying for the 10 shows. Okay, now I want to bring up something else here. Next thing. Seriously? I do wish it would. Okay, now. Give me one split second here to pull up one more thing here. I had been looking for a graphic, a picture that was important for a part of this lecture, and oddly enough, one of the few places that picture is around these days is in textbooks. If you'll bear with me here, one moment, I'll show you the next part of this. Come on, seriously. There it is. Good. Okay. I can go on to the next thing. Okay. That is the practical use of standard deviations, one of the most practical uses. Now, in terms of return on stock and risk of stock, you can do just a plain old for your expected return, add up the annual return for the last 5 years or something like that, divide by five, that's your expected return. Your standard deviation would be your volatility of the returns over that period of time and all that good stuff. That's not a very good measure of it. The bottom line is, as I've said over and over again, that a lot of stocks have most of their volatility. You're not going to get any reward for, because that volatility you could get rid of in a well-diversified portfolio. It works like this. Your friend isn't here tonight because I was figuring I would pick on him. Madam, do you sing in the car? I do too. I suck, but I sing, you know? And you probably are a terrible singer, and so are you. You, I don't know, maybe. You should laugh. You are horrible. I mean, your car quits when you start singing. Okay, here's the deal, though. When you put a bunch of people together, no matter how much bad there is in that each of those individual singers, you get a much, much smoother sound. An incredible sound. In fact, it is so much a part of the nature of things for them to cancel out each other's peculiarities and to bring forth a harmonic that is not in any of them. That we can see this in everything from insurance and stocks to kinesiology to stellar atmospheres and envelopes to the way galaxies spin over hundreds and hundreds of millions of years. We see it everywhere. There's a YouTube video, if you ever get a chance. There was an entomologist. It was some kind of a natural scientist. He recorded the crackling of crickets at night, loud, noisy. He compiled a bunch of recordings, and then he put them together and slowed it down to about a tenth of the speed. Maybe it was a third, I don't know. And it sounded like the greatest symphony that had ever been played on Earth. It was amazing what happens. When I am an insurance company, the one thing that a life insurance company, I know that if I insure you and you and you, you could be sick, but that would be when you weren't sick. You might be a little sick, you might be incredibly healthy. And then when you got sick, I know that you wouldn't be sick, neither would you, and neither would you. Each part would be canceled out in its peculiarities, and you would get an underlying hum that would be the population or the large samples cost. And this is what happens with stocks, with bonds, with securities of all kinds, is that they cancel out each other's oddities, their business peculiarities, and you get this beautiful flow. Over a period of securities, over a group of securities, if you are talking about risk level, by any measure you would want, as you add stocks to a portfolio or securities, the risk level falls. The volatility of the portfolio falls. It doesn't fall to zero. It falls to a level that we call the non-diversifiable risk of the market portfolio. Theoretically, at an infinitely large portfolio, or at least of the world portfolio, you would have no unsystematic risk left. But you really don't need to get a huge, like I said before, at about 95%, you are in good shape as far as shaking out non-systematic risk goes, the diversifiable risk. Now, actually, I was digging online, and then it occurred to me there's a picture in your textbook that is just an excellent presentation of this phenomenon. Right there it is. Now, if you look at these portfolios, you will see something fascinating. This, too, is a phenomenon of nature. Actually, that's a twist on the same phenomenon. See those portfolios and see individual or little individual stocks underneath them? The individual stocks will never have as much return for the risk level that is born as the portfolios will. Here's what's going on. This is a principle of physics. It's actually a principle beyond physics. You see it in chemistry, in astronomy, in kinesiology. You see it everywhere. You didn't happen to ever see the movie, the original Rocky movie, did you? You saw it? Oh, man. I mean, I was young, and there was Rocky, this miserable, flabby, back alley boxer. And then he started exercising. You remember? And I mean, I actually did that thing. He put 5 raw eggs into a glass and he drank them for protein. I tried that too. You want to talk about a debris field, you know? But at the same time, he started exercising.
Now, let's imagine you are going to do the same thing. Every day, you start to you decide, I'm going to exercise. You get stronger. And then every day, you start hearing this music in the background. Ba, 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 ba. And you start talking more and more like Rocky. Come here, kill them all. And all that. But there's a point you can't go beyond. There is a point where you no longer can build muscle mass. There is a point where you cannot lift anymore. No matter how hard you try, you can't get past that limit. There's one for you too. It's not his, it's yours. If you were to decide to start running, there would be a maximum speed, no matter what you did, no matter how much you trained, no matter what you ate, you could not get beyond that speed as a runner. That is called, in physics, what we call this phenomenon is an envelope. There is a point of performance we can't get beyond. In building cars, there is a performance envelope. No matter what you do, that engine cannot get any more efficient. No matter what you do, that car cannot get any more fuel efficiency. In airplanes, there was a movie, Aviators, a few years back about Howard Hughes. He wanted to get an airplane that he could race faster than any other airplane. However, there were all these technological innovations that he put into it, but there was a point where he could not get any more speed out of it. The envelope. It's a performance envelope. We see it in chemistry. There is only so much exothermic action you can get out of a certain chemical reaction. In a business, we can put money in, but there's only so much we can do to get performance out of our machines. There's only so much we can do as far as investment to generate more revenue, and then we can't get any more revenue. The envelopes are everywhere in the universe. Performance envelopes. Every star is a performance envelope pushing at its limit. So what we see here in this diagram that you're seeing right here, that is the envelope of performance of portfolios. And no matter what you hear, well, I know how to get that past that. No, you don't. Now, we do see anomalies. Don't get me wrong. There are oddities. We see things that kind of pop up. See how you got a few that kind of almost like they're pop up a little bit above for a while? Generally, those are temporary. There are a few that we don't quite get why they behave. They always seem to be a little on the other edge of the performance envelope. But that is not something that lasts for long. Okay, it just isn't something. If you see, for example, I see a stock that is getting a higher risk, a higher return for the risk that is being taken than anything else, well, I can assure you that there are a bazillion supercomputers and super geniuses who are going to find that stock sooner or later, probably within microseconds anymore. I mean, it used to be, you know, days, weeks, years, possibly. But anymore, they'd find it very quickly. They'd buy into it, drive the price up, and absorb that extra return so it was no longer there by driving the price of the stock up through their purchases. So even if something is beyond the performance envelope briefly, it won't stay there too long, especially anymore with how many powerful computers are watching everything every split second and all of that. Okay. See the one down there at the bottom, treasury bills. That's sort of like a base, a baseline. You can invest in a treasury bill. You're not taking any risk whatsoever. And you get a modest, a tiny expected return. Some kind of an expected return. Let's say that this risk-free rate is 1.5%. So now, if I were to look at, okay, this is a few years back. Looking at this chart, can you call it for me? What do you see is the return on the world portfolio? What do you see there? On the world portfolio. Do you see it? You don't see it? Huh? 10%. Yeah, it's about 10%. Truth be told, that's not too far off now, although it has... Right now, I'd say it's probably closer to 9.2%, but that's not bad. Okay, so this would be about as close as we could get to the market portfolio. That would be a security that has a beta of, that would be a portfolio that has a beta about as close to pure 1.0 as you could get. So I could say that the expected return to the market portfolio is about 10.0%. So here would be a beta of 0. Here would be a beta of 1, approximately. Now, anything past that, you've got more risk. See the more volatility, more risk. And you've got a higher average return out there. So in a sense, although it is not a perfectly straight line, we can imagine that there is a line out there. Well, this treasury bill rate, what do you see there? Is that about 3%? I did the top one with what it is now and the bottom with what it was on the chart. Okay, historically, K sub F by that chart is about 3%. Right now, it's about 1.5%, and the world portfolio is more like about 9.2%. But I'll stick with this chart right here. Now, what this sets up for us, is essentially like a linear equation. If I were to mark beta and expected return, what that would tell me is that this line has, for a beta of 0, an expected return of 3.0%, and for a beta of exactly 1, it has an expected return of about 10.0%. Okay. That is the basis, and I won't push this point any further, but that is the basis. Remember from your algebra, if I have 2 points on a line, then I can create the line by the two-point form, find the slope and the intercept and all, the y-intercept and all that kind of good stuff. Well, that's the basis of creating the capital asset pricing model. It's purely empirical. We say, all right, what's the return on a beta of 0? What's the return on a beta of 1, approximately? Okay, there's the capital market line. But what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to bring up something here. K sub F is the risk-free rate. K sub M is the expected return to the market portfolio. Okay. K sub M, the expected return to the market portfolio, minus K sub F, the risk-free rate, is what we call the short-term market premium. You'll hear me use the term market premium. It's the reward you expect to get for investing in the market portfolio instead of a risk-free instrument. It's the reward you expect for taking market risk, just pure market risk. It's like a leveraging point for us. Anyone can get the risk-free rate. If you want to invest in the market portfolio, you get a little reward, or at least you should expect a reward for it. Now, the full name of this is the expected return to the market portfolio over risk-free. The expected return to the market portfolio over the risk-free rate. That's the full name of it, the expected return to the market portfolio over the risk-free rate. The informal name you'll hear me use, the informal name for this is the market premium, or you'll hear me say the market premium over risk-free, to make sure that you know that it is, this is not the return to the portfolio. This is what we expect to get in addition, extra for bearing risk of the market portfolio. So in other words, in this graph right here, I would look at this and I'd say, okay, from 3% to about, that's a little more than 10% there, but let's say 10%. That jump there from risk-free to beta of 1, that's 7%. For this chart, that was the market premium. It's essentially just that difference right there, the market premium over risk-free. 7% about in this case. In that case, what is it now? What's the return to the market portfolio? Well, depending upon whom you ask, interestingly enough, there are services that actually, this is so important for business, for investing, internal business, we need this. For investing, we need this. There are several services that report the expected return to the market portfolio. What they do is these different services have their own cluster of experts, industry experts, academic experts, that they poll them a couple of times a year and say, all right, what do you think the market return, the market premium is? Or what's the return to the market portfolio right now? In other words, what's case about? I'm in one of those polls with 72 other industry and academics. And there are, like I said, there are several different ones that you can go to get this information. But right now, what they ask, they just go around. Now, one thing I do want to show you here, for your own purposes, what is the return to the market portfolio? What is the expected return to the market portfolio? I'm looking for, you're not going to see on these kinds of sites. I was actually doing this kind of out of curiosity. You have to subscribe usually to a service, or you have to go a little bit deeper. I'm looking. Nope. I don't see it. Usually you have to subscribe to some service. You guys have actually access to the Standard & Poor's, the entirety of S&P, as part of your, as being students here. You can go into the Standard & Poor's really deep screens and do incredible research. I think they showed you that in Business 100, at least I did back in the day. But you'll find it there. Right now, The market portfolio is probably pulling right now, expected, not historical, expected forward, about 9.2% right now. So right now, expected, going forward, is about 9.2%. That's not just mine. That would be the designation of a group that I'm in. The risk-free rate, you can go to Treasury bills, and that's something we can do right now. That one is easy enough to find. T-bill rate. Department of the Treasury. For some reason, how hard can it be? Bank discount. Well, I ask for one thing and I get something else. That really irritates the hell out of me when I do that. Bank rate. Okay. Okay, 0.66%. That's ridiculously low. And don't notice, though, that it is going up. So right now, the market premium over risk-free would be about 9.2% less 0.66%. I'm not even going to try to do that in my head. I'm so bad at math anymore. Okay, 9.2 minus 0.66. 8.54. That would be the additional reward you would get for investing in the market portfolio. Now, let me show you what that means, practically speaking, for an investor. Taking this off. Okay, imagine that there is a line right here, a line right here. Okay? Now, I want you to imagine what happens if the Federal Reserve begins to tighten the money supply, but the market has already done its reaction. The world portfolio, the market portfolio, stays on its fulcrum, but the Treasury bill rate begins to push upward. You see that actually will cause the line, the capital market line, to flatten. You see how it flattens it? And that pushes the returns on all stocks above one downward. You see that? If this is the beta of one right here, and the capital market line begins to rotate on that fulcrum of the world market portfolio, what's going to happen is that will suppress returns on investments that are risky. And actually might even improve somewhat low-risk investments. The market begins to reward defensive portfolios. That's the first thing that's a practical implication. Now, suppose also, though, that as the Fed ratchets up interest rates, that causes the expected return to the market portfolio to fall. So not only is this line rotating downward, flattening, it is also dropping that way, dropping downward. So it's rotating downward and it's also flattening. That would increase that would cause the returns on these portfolios up here, small stock, mid-cap, S&P 500, they would not only fall, they would fall more rapidly because not only was the line rotating against them, but it was also falling against them too. So their returns would start going down for two reasons. What that means is in an environment where the Fed is farting and threatening and hinting that it's going to bring the interest rates upward, that could have serious implications on the construction of a good portfolio. Again, I always tell you, Buy and hold. Don't just jerk your portfolio around. But with the education that you have from being in my class, thank God you're in my class, you actually know more than just to sit there like a doofus and let the winds of time blow your portfolio around. You can do a little bit. In a case like this, if you honestly believe that the Fed is finally going to get its guts about it and start pushing up interest rates, that would mean that you would probably want to move towards a slightly more defensive portfolio, because the aggressive portfolios are going to lose more than the defensive portfolios will. Now, if the world market portfolio stays about the same, you're probably going to benefit more from defensive portfolios vis-a-vis aggressive portfolios. If the Fed's actions start pushing all interest rates upward, returns on stocks will all go down, then that probably means that you're going to lose money no matter what you do. However, how much you lose is still going to be less on a defensive portfolio than it would be on an aggressive portfolio. So that's the practical implication of knowing what I'm teaching you here, is that it's not just academic. And again, in the next lecture, I will bring up the capital asset pricing model, which basically I've shown you here, its usefulness. But you'll also see that there is a lot more to it than just academics. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.